Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Be Above Leadership and Today Life Advice Show. I am Ursula Pottinger and I'm here with my good friend Anne Betts. We are co-founders of Be Above Leadership. And at Be Above Leadership, we train coaches, we coach coaches, and we mentor coaches. Mm-hmm. And so one of our favorite things to do is giving advice to our students and where we can mentoring. So welcome, Anne. It's just so fun to be here. So why do you love mentoring and advising coaches?
I mean, I'm just giggling over here, and it's always so fun to talk with you. I'm giggling because as I'm also, as you are, a regular coach, and I do regular coaching. And unlike the sitcom view of coaching, I do not tell people what to do. I do not give advice when I am hired as a coach. I hold that person as creative, resourceful, whole. My job is to help them find their way. And so as a result, I suppress a lot of what I think. And, you know, in service of them, because we know from neuroscience that works better. The light bulb goes off in their head, not mine. But it is actually lovely when I have a mentoring relationship, when somebody comes and says, hey, Anne, what would you do? I just feel like it's like I'm letting loose the horses. Oh, yay, I get to give advice.
Yeah, I know. It's so sweet. And I want to say something to this, that mentoring and giving a little bit advice, and we train actually this piece in a different program, there is actually room for it, but it's really the client, number one, has to ask for it, and we have to do it definitely with restraint. And I think that is where, you know, your comment comes in. It's like we have to hold back so much. But sometimes in the coaching call, my clients often say, well, what would you do? And with respect, with restraint, and having this deep and very judgment-free relationship of kindness and compassion, I sometimes say, you know, I've been in this situation and here is what I did. Is this helpful? So I also think that every now and again, a little bit of advice actually fits in.
I was using the metaphor today in one of the classes we got into talking about cooking, and I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and we like hot food here and we like hot chili. And, you know, this, and I said, many things in coaching, you don't want to make it the whole meal, but you sprinkle a little bit in and it spices everything up. And I think sometimes a tiny little bit of advice is like adding a little bit of a chili to the stew. But today, this is our advice show, so get ready for some, this is the whole meal. It's the whole meal of advice.
The horse has been let loose.
Just to mix our metaphors there. So, Ursula, I'm curious, you know, what has been an interesting advice question you've gotten from a coach recently? What's been something they've asked you about? And let's see if we can mull on that from a neuroscience perspective.
That would be great. And it's really interesting that we have sort of started with metaphors, because that is where I'm going. So I had somebody just recently saying to me, you know, I know metaphors can be so powerful, but I don't know if this really works, because I have this client that just doesn't get it. You know, what should I do, and how should I even bring it to this client? So it's metaphors that sometimes can, I think, trip coaches up.
Yeah, and well, so what advice did you give her? And then I'm happy to weigh in.
Well, one of the things that I said, you know, metaphors is a big, broad word and a big bucket. So I said to her, you know your clients well, so go into the arena where they already have a connection. Like, for example, if you were to coach me, you would know that I love tennis. So tennis can become an area.
I would ask for a tennis metaphor. Absolutely. Keep going.
Exactly. So you know, as you know, if you were my coach, that I love tennis. You know that I love camping. You know that I have a dog. So these are three areas where one could use these areas and bring in a metaphor, because the client and the client's brain has already a mental map in their brain that makes sense, that can identify with it. So don't just throw the word metaphor out at them where they just, you know, have this deer in the headlights look, but have it be more specific, you know, to something that they can identify with.
I think that has been so helpful for me. And there are, in, as you say, you get to know your clients. This is something you can learn fairly early. I have clients, a few, it's not the majority, but a few that all I have to do is say what metaphor is coming to mind. And we are off on a pirate ship and it's a stormy sea and there's gold. God knows what's happening. And I'm just like along for the ride. But I would say that that's not, those are generally people that have done a lot of personal work. Probably it is a coach who's worked with metaphors. So their brain is attuned to sort of allow that in. But I very rarely say what is a metaphor if it's someone where this is not the main language they are used to or aware of speaking. And I love what you're saying. I will say more instead, you know, what kind of software program is this? You know, like if you're telling me about some way you're feeling about something or some challenge you've got coming up, and I know you're a software engineer, I might say, God, what's this software program? Oh my God, it's full of bugs. And they won't even hesitate because I'm speaking their language. What video game is this? What, you know, what, if they're a cook, what is, you know, what are you cooking? Because I really want to highlight something you said I thought is so brilliant. They already have a mental map. You are entering their world. And so generally, I find that that works really, really well. I have one other
thing
to add. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say, and the funny thing about this is they often don't even know that they're using it as a metaphor. They already talk like that, and one has to almost point out to them what you just said, that is actually a metaphor.
Because they're so comfortable in it, and it's so real to them and like that. And I will also say this was sort of a learning that I had where I was teaching something in our program, and one of the students was having a hard time grasping it, and I just kept using another metaphor. Well, it's like this, and it's like that. And it just was like, oh my God, I'm just making it worse. And what was interesting for her was that I think stressed her out. And we ended up meeting one by one. And I explained it somehow intuitively. I just explained it as clearly and succinctly without metaphor. And she looked at me and she said, why didn't you say that before? And I thought, right. And this was someone who was definitely not completely what we call neurotypical. Her brain had a somewhat different way of processing. And so for her, for this particular thing, and that doesn't mean she might not use metaphor in a different time. Metaphor wasn't off the table with her, but in terms of something she needed to understand, she actually needed it in the most linear way. And that was a good learning.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. You know, and you're talking about something really interesting. You know, when the brain is stressed over something, we also don't think as clearly, and maybe that also has an impact.
Yeah, and I think that was part of it, is that she had gotten to the point where she was so stressed, she was really kind of blocking anything that I was saying. And so I do think with clients, in both cases, we're sort of pointing to the same thing. From a neuroscience perspective, what you want to do is understand your client's context and work as well as you can within their context. It will be more brain friendly for them.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Well, that's my metaphor advice piece. How about you? What's been showing up for you that's kind of interesting?
Well, I think one of the things that I tend to get a lot of questions about is, so one of the things that we train in our programs is we look at everything possible that will help people learn, change, grow, you know, achieve what they want. And often that takes us outside of just ask another powerful question. Powerful questions are great. They're the cornerstone of coaching. I believe in them. But often what the client needs is something that is more novel, that is more unusual, and because that will help really stimulate a breakthrough. So for example, getting into their body, you know, moving around, using objects, getting stuff out of their brain. And what I found is that that sometimes the question that I get is, you know, how do I do that? The client is just going to think I'm weird. So, you know, first of all, like that's okay. You can be weird. You're a coach. It's all right. You don't have to be, so, you know, typical, because the typical probably isn't necessarily serving them. So I think that's one that I have had to give a fair amount of advice about over the years. And here's what I say. I mean, there's a number of things, and I know you've got some stuff to weigh in on, but I want to, you know, first go to the, you know, I want to get my client to maybe get up and move, but they're going to think that that's weird, is to say, you know, the advice that I give is to say something like this to the client. Look, you hired me for a breakthrough. You hired me for movement. You hired me for whatever they, you know, some kind of change, some kind of goal. That, you know, there is something called the definition of insanity, which is if you keep doing the same thing, you're going to get the same result. So we're not going to do the same thing. We're going to bring in everything we can to activate the intelligence of your entire system. And so I may ask you to do some things that you maybe haven't done before. I'm not going to embarrass you, but we may get up and move because we want to see what your body might know about this. And, you know, I do some kind of introduction like that. I usually try to remember to do that personally in my first meeting with them, but that's what I want the coach to do. I also want them to stop doubting themselves and sometimes just do it, because it's going to be memorable for the client. And the question about I'm weird is actually more in the coach's head than it is in the client. They don't know what coaching is supposed to be generally, most of them. And so if you say, spit spot, this is what we do. This is coaching. Get up out of your chair. Show me that posture. What does it look like when you're feeling really grounded? Things like that. They don't know that you're not supposed to, you know, they don't know. They don't think it's weird because they haven't been coached before. So the weirdness conversation is usually a block in the client.
In the coach.
So let me pause there because I know you probably have a million things to say about this as well.
No, but if I totally agree with you that when this comes up, it is, I often ask, you know, the coach, okay, what's weird about it to you? What makes you think this is weird? And that often really sort of turns on a light bulb in the coach. And I go exactly where you go in terms of saying, you know, you need to bring some reasoning into the mix. And this is why I love bringing neuroscience into the conversation of coaching and human effectiveness, because now there is evidence. There is a reason why we do this. And you said that so beautifully. The body has its own intelligence. And if you only use part of the system, you only get part of the information. You know, it's like saying if you have six team members and you only use three, and not the other three, where you only get 50% of what you need to know. So
well,
embodiment, so embodiment is part of your team. It's part of your system. And if you don't use it, you're going to lose some of the most important information and intelligence that you have. So let's do it. And I always giggle when I listen to some of my, you know, coach clients who sort of say, well, this might be useful and we might be doing this. And it's like, no, strike the word might out of your vocabulary, because it does work. It works. It's not, it might work, it will work. So
yeah,
very much in line with your, you know, weirdness conversation as a coach, you need to check in with yourself. What's the internal conversation you have about using metaphors, embodiment, that this particular client where you go, this might be weird.
Or this is, sounds a little weird, like get rid of weird, get rid of what might, you know. And Ursula, you know what you're making me think of? You're also making me think of the process of neuroplasticity, you know, sort of our own, both in terms of the client, helping them, quote, sort of wire in different beliefs, different attitudes, different actions, things like that, but also the process as a coach. So, you know, when I started out as a coach 20 years ago, over 20 years ago, I thought everything was weird, even asking about, I was so nervous about everything, you know, the idea of having, even asking someone, what's your current perspective? I mean, about the only thing I didn't think was weird was asking someone what their values were. But it very quickly became clear to me, if that's all I ever did as a coach, I wasn't going to be very successful. So I had to get past my own internal barrier of, gosh, I have this coaching tool and I'm not sure I totally understand it and I'm awkward and they're going to think I'm, you know, terrible, because no one ever did. And so I think a big part of it is, the more that we practice expanded skills, whatever they are, metaphor, I don't care, drawing, using the body, all of that, and we see as coaches the breakthrough results that are happening for our clients when we get out of just the safety of powerful questions, what ends up happening is it validates something for us. And we're much more confident when we say, okay, Ursula, I want you to stand up. Because the first time I ever asked anybody to do that, I was so sure they were going to say no. They didn't. But I had to learn it, you know?
Yeah, and I really love your link between evidence gathering and neuroplasticity, because really what we're talking about here is, through repetition, something that feels very uncomfortable, through repetition and doing it again and again and gathering the evidence that it works, it will become more of a comfort zone. And I see this sometimes with our students in our program. I had this a couple of weeks ago when there was a new tool, and the person said, you know, I was very hesitant of using this tool. I didn't know if it would work. And my internal conversation to myself was, well, I have used this tool probably 100 times and I know it works. So that thought would never occur to me. But it's neuroplasticity. She had never used this tool before. So obviously there was doubt, while, you know, I just knew. I mean, it has worked every time. So my doubts are just not there anymore.
Well, exactly. And I think about, you know, one of the things that you and I do, because it's fun and entertaining and keeps us, you know, excited, is we are constantly creating new coaching tools. And, you know, so it's a brand new thing. And I notice, you know, I've been practicing some with you for another program, some new tools. And I, you know, I generally come in going, don't know if this is going to work, and feeling really awkward, and, you know, I'm ruffling my papers, but having my notes available and saying to you, hold on, I need to look up what I'm supposed to do next. That's fine. Nobody cares.
You know, and Yeah, and this actually, this might bring me to another piece of advice that's not so much about the client, but also more about, you know, who are you as a coach. I mean, I really believe in transparency, and I think sometimes we think it has to be all slick and we have to be so masterful at it. You know, as you said, our clients don't care. They already love us. We already have this trusted relationship. So I believe completely in honesty. If I have a new tool, I will say, hold on, I need to get my hand out. I need to get the instructions because it's step by step and I don't know them all by heart yet because I haven't used it that often. So I haven't memorized it.
Well, and you know, I have to say a couple things there. One is from a client perspective, if I had been working with a coach for a bit and the coach said, I have a new tool. I've got this brand new tool. I don't know it that well yet, but I want to try it out on you. I'd be like, oh, goody. That sounds like fun. I'm intrigued. You know, maybe that's my weird brain. The other thing I wanted to say to what you were talking about transparency is there's an authenticity there. And I think for many of our clients, particularly those trying to survive in the organizational world, they see enough nonsense. They see enough BS.
Mm.
And, you know, the slick and the, you know, all put together. And that's not what they hired you for. And often what stands out for our clients about us as coaches is how authentic we are.
Mm-hmm.
As coaches. And so, you know, this feeling that because they're paying me X $100 per hour, I better have it all slick and put together. I would say 99 out of 100 clients don't want that. They find it inspiring that we have learned to just be ourselves and not be slick and put together. Maybe 1 out of 100 wants that. Great. They can go find a coach who does that. And I promise you their results won't be as good.
You know, and this then leads me to this other place. You know, we've talked about advice and mentoring, but it also opens the door to a little bit of storytelling from our own lives if it is in service of the client. So if they are facing a, let's say, parenting dilemma and they have teenagers, and I have raised two kids into adulthood, I know what it's like, and I know so have you, and
yeah.
They're really struggling and they're stuck. It's saying, you know, I remember when our daughters were at this age. I remember this so well, and this is how I felt. I felt just as frustrated as you are, and here's what we can do about it. This little storytelling opens a little window to our own life that can be very engaging and connecting.
Yeah, and I think there's a, you know, it's what I think you and I have come to call sort of the two layers deep into it. So one of the things that I love when I got trained as a coach, so just the complexity of all of this. One of the things I loved was I learned not to have the attention on me and that all the attention was on the other person. And that is such a gift. And it's so rare. It's so rare to find someone in the world who is just present with you. I mean, oh my gosh, I think that's one of the things our clients love more than anything. Once we've mastered that, once we've mastered the ability to not make conversation about ourselves, to not go, oh yeah, me too, I love that, yes, I did this, and when I was a such and such, I did that. Once we've mastered the ability to not do that, I think we can, and I think what you're saying is, we can bring it back a little bit with the orientation, this is for the sake of the client, and I'm going to keep it as short as possible, and back to them. Because what I'm so struck by, Ursula, is this is something I always think about and say, is that in human history, we have always learned through story. We sit at the fire, we tell stories, we have fairy tales, we have myths. This is how we learn. And so the idea that it's now just off the table and never do that, and that makes you a bad coach, doesn't feel right to me. But I think the question is how we do it. I think that's what you're saying.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's always my big sort of neon light is always, is it in service of the client? What is in service of the client? How can I serve the client? And so sometimes a brief story, whatever it might be, whether from my own life or from something that I've read or a quote, can really help the client move them to new insights. So, but it has to be in service of the client.
Yeah. And we have to be really discerning about what is the story that will open something up for them. And I think sometimes, you know, you and I have been around this world for 20 some years. We have a successful business. I know sometimes people look at me like, well, she can't possibly have any problems. You know, she's just figured it all out. And so hearing about the process of sometimes of how I figured it out and when I was in the dark pit of despair and how did I get out of it? That's the story that I think can be so useful. The stories that show the way forward, because I wasn't, you know, you and I both had to do a lot of personal work and rely on each other a lot in order to get where we are today. It did not happen magically, let me tell you. And it wasn't because we followed all of the, you know, self-help advice on YouTube and TikTok and Instagram. We didn't, back in our day, we didn't have any of that. You know, we just kind of tried to figure out what it was to, you know, have an ethical, you know, service-oriented business and made a lot of mistakes along the way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I mean, we really did the hard work and are still continuing the hard work. I mean, you and I, are the proverbial climbing buddies on the journey of life and transformation. Now, talking about novelty and moving forward, there is then, I think, one of the sort of big questions is, okay, this client is wanting to move something forward. I get a lot of, I'm almost done with my website, or I want to write a book and I've started, but I'm stuck. I can't move forward. It's, you know, I don't know. I am blocked. I get a lot of that in terms of, you know, when I coach, especially beginning entrepreneurs or coaches. Yeah. You're giggling. What are you laughing about?
I'm giggling because there's a couple of things here, and then I want to hear what advice you give, because there is this, I call those, sometimes there's the sort of, a coach will come and say, this client wants this, but, you know, they won't do anything and all of that. I call them, well, that's a magic wand client. They think because they paid you that you're going to pull out your handy dandy little magic wand. And, you know, all they have to do is show up on the coaching session and bing, you have this amazing insight and you'll never procrastinate again. And, you know, so I always sort of laugh gently about that, but I think it is something that, and I'll tell you the advice that I give when it's that kind of client. It's not always that kind. Sometimes people are genuinely stuck, but these darn magic wand clients, because I paid for you to coach me, I am expecting magical breakthroughs. I say, you've got to design with them very clearly that it is their job to do the work and that they have not bought some, you know, you're not Yoda and you're not the fairy godmother and you can't just magic it for them because they didn't buy that. They bought you as a container for them to do the work. And those are the clients I fire. I haven't had to fire very many clients in my time as a coach, but those clients who cannot seem to get that it is their job to go forth and do the work and come back every time not having done their homework with more excuses, it's because I feel like they're magic wand clients.
You know, I'm glad you said that. This is not where I was going, but I know. Exactly.
I know. There's a whole other place to go for sure. Let's go there. They're not no, all but like...
I, No, and I think more often than not, they are not like that because they are genuinely stuck. And what I usually point them to is, you know, what is the fear? There is some fear that blocks them. It's, you know, fear of, like, when it's a website, for example, or a talk that they want to deliver, it's often the fear of visibility, of showing who they really are. They feel they need to hide behind, you know, more doing and more, you know, wordsmithing and another picture on the website, another, you know, redesign, another tweak of this. And that stops them to actually step out into the world and showing the world who they really are. So I think it's, for me, it's like exploring, well, what's the fear that stops you from stepping into the world out there? And so there is that. And then, you know, depending on how long I've been working with a client on this very topic, I sort of go the Nike commercial route. It's just do it.
Yeah. There are some things that you can't get. You can't, you know, you can't stand on one side of the river wishing your way across the bridge, analyzing the bridge, drawing maps to get across the bridge. Sometimes the only way to see that it's okay on the other side of the river is to one foot after the other, you know, cross the bridge. And that's when I'm with you and I do things like break it into as many mini steps as possible, you know, rewards for each step. I think some of the really good current research on change says it's all about, you know, you want to make things as automatic as possible. Change is best understood as a whole bunch of habits. And so focus on one habit at a time. Like, you know, I'm going to be healthy. Well, let's take one thing, start drinking water. Like, what's one thing? Low-hanging fruit. One thing, I'm going to start drinking water every day. Okay, great. When that's locked in and it feels more automatic, and maybe there's a little reward because you drank your water, I don't know, then add the next thing until you sort of all of these together give you the overall, you know, like, hey, I've really moved the dial on my health. Like that, breaking it down, embedding rewards. I think also the piece about this one, you know, it's really interesting because I'm exploring this myself. So this sounds really silly, but one of the things they say, like, if you want to start running is, like, you want to start working out in the morning, one of the best things you can do is put your workout clothes right next to your bed and put them on first thing, because you're sort of embedding the habit of running in with putting clothes on. Now, what's really interesting is I usually wear slippers around the house, but I've been wanting to use my treadmill more. And so when I put my tennis shoes on, I feel more inclined to go use my treadmill. It's like they're associated. The brain is very associative. If you spend all day, now if you work from home, obviously you don't, it's another issue, but if you spend all day in your workout clothes and don't work out, it can feel a little weird. So
that's really interesting.
You
know, that's really interesting. And, you know, I mean, I know that the brain is very associative, as you have pointed out. And I also love this whole concept of automation, because it just is too much of an effort for the brain to constantly look at change. And yes, I will do it. And no, I won't do it. But sort of having these habits more embedded makes complete sense. But this interesting aspect of what we wear and where we do certain things has a huge influence on whether we do it or not. You know, for example, you know, if you sit on a cozy couch with, you know, with a cozy pillow, but you have to do something that's maybe very structural or is very business oriented, and you can't get going, you might need to move your body to your computer and your desk. Because your brain and your body will recognize, oh, now we're working versus now we're relaxing.
You know, I think anything we can do to make it easier, and I love that example. And some of this, forgive us if this sounds sort of obvious, but the big piece to take away is change is cognitively consumptive. What I mean by that is it consumes a lot of cognitive energy and literally glucose in your brain, glucose, hormones, salts, everything that your brain needs to run and, you know, run your body. So when I've got a client who says, you know, this is the year I get in shape and lose weight and I'm going to stop drinking wine and I'm going to exercise an hour every day and I'm going to lift weights and I'm going to stop eating carbs and I'm going to no more sugar, and I'm exhausted by the time they're saying, I'm like, oh, okay. And I don't want to be like a Debbie Downer and be discouraging, but I know all of that together, their head's going to explode and it's not sustainable because of the cognitive effort. So it's let's automate one thing or maybe two, you know, automate something, make it a habit and give the brain something to go towards rather than something to go away from. It's easier to start for our brains. It's easier to start than stop. So what can I start doing and what's the reward of doing it? Like that tends to work better, but I don't allow seven new goals in a matter, because it's a recipe to lose, and then you have more evidence that you can't follow through, and that's not good.
Oh yeah, no, I think that's completely overwhelming, and it's sort of an interesting point that you know, the cognitive load of having to say no all the time, or looking at I can't, is really interesting. I shared this with my beloved and dear husband, so hopefully he will not listen to this show because I'm going to have to out him here a little bit. You know, I said to him the other day, you know how hard it is for my brain to always say no.
Yeah.
Would you like another glass of wine? No, thank you. Would you like dessert? No, thank you. Well, we have ice cream. Would you like that? No, thank you. I mean, by the time the evening is done, I'm exhausted. And then if he asks me one more time, well, how about this? My brain is breaking down. My resistance is breaking down because my brain has said no so many times that it just can't anymore. So it ends up saying yes when I really don't want to.
When you don't want to. I know, I'm thinking about, and this is the, you know, you and I have used this metaphor before, and I really like it. I'm remembering when my son was little and, you know, he would get a hold of the car keys or something I didn't want him to have, you know, a knife, whatever it was. And the worst thing to do would be to, like, you know, give me that back. And then you get the little he, and he runs away. The best thing to do would be to give him a cookie or give him a teddy bear or something. And then he stops being so interested in the keys or whatever it is he's got. I think our brains operate somewhat that way. If you give them, you know, I'm wondering if you could ask him to start asking you, would you like a cup of tea, honey?
Well, I have simply said, please don't ask me anymore. It is just too hard for me to say no.
You know, but here's what I know. I'm just little advice. This is not coaching. This is advice. But I know this woman for over 20 years, and I know her husband. I'm going to suggest something. Can I give you some unsolicited advice?
Oh, totally. Give it to me.
Your husband is an acts of service to the bone.
Yeah.
He loves to serve, and I'm sure he also loves to have you join him in ice cream. I know that. Don't give him a no. Give him a yes. Give his brain a yes. Say, honey, I want to start drinking chamomile tea at night, or I want to start whatever it is. And give him, you know, so I would love it if you would ask me if I want a cup of tea. Because then given him something to do.
And I can say yes instead of no. That's a really, really great idea, because I usually say, no, thank you. I'm going to make myself a cup of tea. But I like that approach better, because then I only have to say yes, please.
Yes, please. And then he gets to serve. He gets to bring you something. And you, if he's having wine, you can have tea, and then you're sharing together. So I'm thinking... Stop trying to get the car keys from him, but you're absolutely right. The brain, it's exhausting to put up boundaries. It's easier to go with the flow. So that would be, let me know how that works.
Oh, I'm sure this will work great. And I know that many coaches have clients that are dealing with something very similar, whether it's being in a working environment or privately, whether it's weight or finances or whatever it might be, this constant having to resist and say no and boundaries can sometimes just be so exhausting that, yeah, you know, I think we just break down. We break down and say yes because you just can't say no anymore.
You know, I think that's something, and one of the things folks may know about us is we work in neuroscience and we also work in trauma and the neuroscience of trauma. And one of the questions I do get from the coaches who are also coaching in trauma, because it is the biggest answer to how do I deal with someone who's being, emotionally abusive or, abusive in any way like that, the biggest answer is boundaries. And so a big question is, how do I get my client to, you know, have more boundaries with their, you know, with their boss, with their parent, with their child even, or with their spouse. Mm-hmm. And so this is a really interesting, do you have any insights around, what would you say to a coach who says, my client needs to step up and have more boundaries?
You know, this is really a bit of a hard question for me because I think I'm sort of the queen of boundaries. So I sometimes,
have cultural support in that, we'll just say.
I have cultural support. Totally. I also know that it is very much for me living in alignment with myself, and it's about respect. It's respecting myself. So I think this is sort of where I would take the conversation in terms of advice. Is, you know, figure out, number one, what is the obstacles to boundaries? Because again, it's often fear, and especially if this person is in a toxic relationship, boundaries are going to be very, very difficult to enforce because there's going to be pushback. And even in a good relationship, sometimes when we change our behavior, people sort of first don't get it. They will say, well, what's wrong with you? You know, why all of a sudden you are saying no to this and you are doing this? So any kind of new behavior that we show other people can sometimes really be threatening to them because you are a new person. The other thing is, you know, aside from toxic relationships, I often say to the client, you know, we train people into behaviors. We train them into not cleaning up after themselves, not putting the dishes away, not showing up on time. So it's looking at, you know, what have we trained this person into? What are they getting away with that no longer suits us, that no longer is in alignment with who we are? And one of the things that really gets me is when people are late. And that's also culturally. I grew up in the German culture, and punctuality is a huge value. Our trains run on time. Our planes run on time. Punctuality is a big deal. And so when people are 10, 15 minutes late, that doesn't work for me. You know, I mean, if it happens once because of traffic or whatever, I mean, I've got lots of room for that. But if it's a pattern of behavior, then something needs to change. So the advice is it a pattern? Is it a one-off? You know, is it really pushing back on some values that you have? And what is the kind of conversation you then need to have in order to figure out what is a boundary that you want to put into place?
You know, and I really am struck by the, you know, so what you said about, you know, people, even so, there's the boundaries in a toxic relationship. You really need to have boundaries for your own mental health and well-being. And then there's the, you know, just what has sort of become the norm, and there's crossover in that. But I'm remembering something a therapist said to me years ago that I've just never forgotten, which is she said all systems are like mobiles. Like a Calder mobile with everything sort of in balance, you know, hanging the way it does. And if you change, you have either added weight or taken off weight, metaphorically, not literally, to the mobile. And so for a while, what will happen, she used this because I started doing some boundaries in my family years ago, and nobody liked it, and everybody went, and she's like, you have to understand, the mobile is now finding its new center, and it will. But you have to be willing to let it find its new center, and don't you go back to the old way just to balance the mobile. So part of the advice, you know, to people is, you know, it's okay to have things be a little uncomfortable. It actually, you know, is not going to kill you usually to have things be a little uncomfortable. Now, I do want to say something where, you know, at the edge of trauma and really toxic relationships, they're also, I do need to just say this because I'm finding myself kind of going there mentally. It's one of the reasons I really believe if you're going to work in that field as a coach, you need some very specialized training.
Yes.
So I have a client where we have to be very thoughtful about the boundaries she puts up with the husband that is, they are in the process of a divorce. And there's some strategy there. It's not just about her being empowered. There is some, you know, strategy, and I am not the only one on her team. And so I just need to put that in as well. But if we're looking at, you know, more things sort of toward the middle where it's, you know, the constantly being asked to do work over the weekend, things like that, that a lot of our clients complain about, or in your example, the family that doesn't clean up, that's where I say be willing to be uncomfortable. And
I love this mobile metaphor, because I mean it's really such a good picture, because it is, you know, it is a very delicate balance, and I just love that metaphor to make it really come alive, that sometimes it just will upset the, you know, the apple cart, and you know, sometimes it will rebalance itself and sometimes it might not.
I would say in my experience with clients who start, you know, standing up for themselves and start saying no and start saying you're going to make your own lunch or whatever it is there, that generally one of two things happens is the mobile finds its way to rebalance. And if they hold the line, the mobile rebalances. Generally, that's what happens, unless you are dealing with a, you know, a psychopath or a really malignant narcissist. The other is that, and this is maybe more in the workplace situation, sometimes in family, I've seen it, is that the mobile says you can no longer be part of our mobile if you're not going to play this game. And then the question, and usually at that point in the coaching, the person has said, you know, if that's what it takes to be in this workplace environment, it's costing me too much.
Yes.
And if that's their response to me saying I'm taking my 2-week vacation, you know, then you know what? I will find something else.
Yeah. No, that's a very good point, because if we can't put into place what really helps us emotionally, physically, you know, it's really about sanity very often. I find boundaries, you know, keep me sane. I mean, I can't have just anybody do anything whenever they like it. It would drive me crazy. So it's for our own well-being. And if we can't do that, then, you know, we need to maybe make a different choice. And I really like the distinction between this is more of a typical, whatever typical means, coaching scenario versus people that are in a toxic relationship or have been, you know, there's been some trauma. And I think there's a really big distinction.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering whether our next show should be on trauma-informed coaching and the differences we see, because you're absolutely right. Through teaching in our own, in Be Above Leadership, that the trauma relational trauma program, I have learned so much, and my coaching in the process has changed quite a bit.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I just want to be really clear that there's a distinction between uncomfortable because I'm not used to speaking up for myself and genuine safety. And so
yes.
But that's at one end of the spectrum. There was something else I was going to say in all of this about the other thing I was going to say is that I generally find, this is interesting, Ursula, I want to know if this is something you found as well, that when what's really on the table is a client needs to reassess, you know, how much they're allowing that doesn't work for them, I would say almost 100% of the time they are having physical symptoms. They're having acid reflux. They are having back problems that won't resolve. There's something their body is also telling them that if you don't change something, there you will not be able to keep going.
Yeah, I think that certainly I can certainly see this in the clients that are, you know, that are executives and work in very stressful environments. They often have trouble sleeping, mm-hmm. you know, and there's, you know, health issues because they also often don't have time to, you know, work out, eat healthy, take a break. And so the whole system, talking about, you know, systems earlier, their whole brain, body, soul, spirit system, the whole system of them gets so out of balance and
right.
gets so neglected that over time it really shows up in many, many areas. And I think that is where the good old foundation of coaching in terms of values can come in handy. It's saying, you know, let's go back to the drawing board and find out what is most important to you and where are you out of alignment and how can we bring this more in alignment? And sometimes it really means leaving.
Yeah, and helping people find a way forward. And I think it's, you know, it's a bit of a yes and, I know you know this as well, that it's, I don't have time to care for this system, but also because of whatever demands I'm in, and it could be a relationship, could be a workplace, I am also constantly on alert and running stress chemicals through my system that we now know have huge health implications. And we've been talking to one of our colleagues who's a longevity expert, and one of the things he comes back to is it's all about inflammation, and being under high stress puts your body in a state of inflammation. So there's nothing weird that says you're going to have physical symptoms when there are mental stress challenges. It's just absolutely predictable. So I think that that's part of, it can be a really, in a weird way, Ursula, sort of a weird blessing. It's like, you know what, maybe my brain could take it, but my body can't take it anymore.
Well, you know, I mean, I know this for myself. I remember and the years when we traveled constantly and often internationally to Asia and Europe, I ended up, as you remember, often with laryngitis. And it was because my system couldn't handle the constant time changes, the stress of, you know, hotels and training and all, my system couldn't handle it. So I would come back home and would lose my voice. And
yeah.
I think that's a really interesting metaphor to lean into and saying you've lost your voice. So what's your body trying to tell you? You know, even if you can't speak, but your body is telling you something.
Yeah. And that makes so much sense. I had a friend who ended up with acid reflux in a toxic workplace. And she said, it's absolutely clear to me, I am swallowing things, you know, there's stuff
Aww.
Going on here I don't like, and I get it, we, you know, she got out, luckily. So, oh my gosh, so many things that we've just barely scratched the surface of in terms of advice to coaches. You know, what I would maybe leave coaches with is, just to pull out, and then I want to see what, you know, sort of your final advice is. But my final advice is also trust that what you bring as a coach, when you are able to pay focused, heartfelt, authentic attention to another human being, is powerfully impactful and powerfully healing. If you are trained as a coach to listen, to not just jump in with advice, but to really work with someone and have space for them, you're inevitably doing more good than probably any other interaction they have in their lives. What would be your final advice, Ursula?
Well, it's very much along the same lines. I really believe that our clients pay us for the container that we create. They pay us for our energy, for our loving kindness, for our curiosity, for the connections that we create. And then your tools and all the little gadgets and gadgets that we use as coaches in so many ways are interesting and novel and fabulous and certainly work. But I think at the end of the day, our clients pay us for our heart-centered and really embracing energy. And I think that's something we need to remember, that that is why they come to us, because of the connections that we create.
Yeah, I agree. Always so fun to talk with you. Everybody stay tuned. We don't know what our next will be, but we're going to start being live, being here on Blog Talk Radio once a month. So just stay tuned and be sure to subscribe to our channel.
Yes, and you can find us on our website where the episodes will be also published, and it's beaboveleadership.com. And Anne and I can be reached at Anne@beaboveleadership and Ursula@beaboveleadership. So here we are. Thanks so much. And as always, super fun. Thanks for listening. We appreciate you. And hopefully we see you soon. Bye-bye.